This is Marty Adam Smith, Spoken Word Hour host, in the studio with writers Gigi Bella, Tori Cardenas, and Mitch Marty. Thank you all so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thanks, Marty.
So, y'all had the chance to read some noir fiction aloud at a local venue at Tractor?
Yeah, the Wells Park Tractor. What was that, last Saturday?
Yeah,
it was Noir at the Bar event, which I guess they have all over the country. I didn't realize.
Oh, cool.
And we're doing the Burke edition, which was really fun. And a couple other readers, Steve Brewer, I think, who owns Organic Books. Mm-hmm. He read some stuff. What was the main guy's name?
Justin Bendel.
Justin Bendel organized it. Yeah, he works at UNM Valencia. Yeah, he was a rock star setting the whole thing up.
Awesome.
I can't organize people, so mad props.
And so Mitch and Tori, y'all have written a short story jointly?
Yeah. So it's called Protect the Pack, and it's in two separate parts, but this is the piece that we read for Noir at the Bar.
All right, we'll take it away whenever y'all are ready.
Cool. So Protect the Pack, Part 1, is also known as What I Did This Weekend. For this assignment, I decided to go to Red Rally. The turnout at this year's Red Rally was one of the biggest I'd ever seen. This is my fourth year at UNM, so I've been to my share of Red Rallies already, but one of my roomies had never been, so we dragged him along too. So what's the point again? Xander's not from here and says New Mexicans have an unhealthy fixation on fire. I mean, we like our chili hot, but we're not a bunch of arsonists. They're the bad guys. We hate them, I said, taking a puff off my wax pen. Yeah, but like, I still don't get it. Why not make a guy out of meat and give it to the zoo wolves? Or better yet, just kidnap some Cruces kid. Xander, haven't you ever heard of Burning Man? Of course. Do you see the point of that? Well, yeah, he's a burning man. Like, that's the point. Besides, don't you have one of those in Santa Fe? I rolled my eyes at Bosco and we pushed Xander from our shack in the student ghetto to the field. Red Rally is a chance for all the Lobos to get together and burn an effigy of our rival from NMSU, Pistol Pete. They're Aggies, which are like ranchers? Makes sense that wolves and ranchers would be rivals, even though the wolves were here first. Anyway, the cheerleaders and the Greeks, or whoever, build him all day, and once it's dark enough to sneak shooters onto Johnson Field, the student body sets the f***er on fire. He's 25 feet tall, and boy, can he burn. We learned all about him in New Mexico history. The sunset was fading as we reached the edge of the crowd, and students piled in behind us to get a good look. Bosco took his flask out of that stupid cowboy hat he wears everywhere and passed it around. The student activities director stepped onto the lifted stage before the big paper Aggie. Both were dressed like the same bargain cowboy, black and white cowhide chaps, revolvers, tiny 10-gallon hats. He tapped the microphone and the crowd cheered before falling silent. Howdy there, Lobos. I'm the Aggie and I came to play. Everyone booed. I finished a swig and I booed too. Hope you're ready for the game tomorrow. My boys are gonna bring it. Lobo Louie, the mascot, hopped up on stage and chased the director away with his long pink tongue dangling behind him. Everyone cheered. See, that's what I'm talking about. Xander clapped his hands together over his head. A guy in an Adidas tracksuit stepped up to the mic and said, Remember, Lobos, look out for your friends tonight. Don't drive drunk. And as always, protect the pack. He tried to get the crowd to say it with him, flapping his arms up and down. It took a few tries, but pretty soon everyone was chanting. That's groupthink from sociology? That's when a lot of people are stupid, but together. But as soon as the director came back on stage, the crowd switched back to booze. He was holding a revolver straight at tracksuit guy. There was an orange bit on the end, but I jumped a little anyway. How can you not nowadays? That's what's called a Pavlovian response. Time to go, Lobo, the Aggie said. I've got a game to win. Tracksuit clapped back, though. Now, guys! And then, like six guys from the football team charged up the stairs, emptying a full orange cooler labeled blood over the director's head, drenching him in a red, viscous fluid. The crowd was going wild, screaming so loud they must have heard us all the way at, like, Academy. Howl for Louie, Tracksuit said. Howl! A chorus of howls rose up from the crowd, every freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior, class of 2020. Louie ran up on stage sniffing just as the director started pushing through the crowd. And then Louie caught the scent. He did a front flip off the stage. As the two sprinted through the student body and into the darkness, Xander yelled, Now that's what I'm talking about. Tracksuit screamed into the mic, "Ready, Lobos!" And the quarterback tossed a flaming football into the Aggies' open mouth. The crowd exploded. Not my kind of football, but still, very cool. The Aggie's body was hollow, so the entire thing was in flames within minutes, enough to illuminate the fire engine parked about 30 feet away. That took the fun out of it for me. What fun there was. But soon, it had nearly burned out and people were leaving. "Okay, boys, where are we drinking?" I asked, rubbing my hands together. I finally had my new license and I was ready to hit up the bars, instead of knocking back shooters in Hakona's basement with some sweaty Rotzi guys. "There's a cute bartender at Copper. Let's go there," Xander said. We dipped through the gym and past the bronze wolf statues by the sub to avoid the herds going to Tractor or wherever. Up ahead of Bosco and me, Xander tripped over something and shouted as he stumbled to the concrete. He scrambled over to the fountain and stood up, dusting off his gym shorts. He had fallen over a man who was asleep under a bench with his legs stretched out. He smelled like malt liquor, my least favorite of all the liquors. Xander and Bosco both took off at a fast walk, leaving the guy behind, mumbling in his sleep. I followed. Beating the rush was essential, but so was not getting robbed. "I hope they put that f***ing wall up soon," Bosco said. "You don't even live on campus anymore, dude. Why do you care?" I asked. "Because my girlfriend still lives here, dude. What if she's taking some books to the library at night and someone tries to hold her up for drug money, or worse?" Bosco slammed his hand against a lamppost, and his class ring left the pole singing. "This is a serious problem, Max. Look at that." He pointed to a man pushing an overloaded shopping cart over by Centennial Library. He was in a pair of cutoffs and a black t-shirt and looked like he hadn't bathed in a long time. "You can get really sick if you don't wash the bacteria away often enough. Exhibit A? The Middle Ages and plagues and but try explaining this or anything really to my friends." "It's gross. I hope the president does something," Bosco went on. "Ah, you know, Strokes is just going to play her games, as usual," Xander said, miming a golf swing. "Look at what she did to the soccer team." He smacked my arm. "All she has to do is make good on the bill. You hear that, you? We won't have to deal with you anymore." Bosco shouted the last part in the direction of the man with the shopping cart, who was walking down the sidewalk. Bosco approached him from behind, and when he had gotten so close he could almost touch the guy, he shouted again, "I said, you hear me?" The guy startled, whipping his head around to catch sight of Bosco, who dashed around the cart, avoiding the homeless guy's swings, laughing. "This is exactly what we need," I thought. "Tetanus." "Help me out, X," Bosco said, and the two of them tipped the cart over. Blankets and backpacks and plastic shards, tennis balls, canned food, and wads of Walmart bags flew everywhere in a huge half circle. The homeless guy screamed at the top of his lungs, and the scream stuck in his throat as Bosco pushed the cart back into him. He barely caught it with his hands. With a swing and a miss, the guy launched himself at Xander and Bosco, but they dodged him easily, and Xander pushed him into Bosco's waiting boot. I don't remember if they were steel-tipped or not, but they were doing some damage. Xander pitched in with his Jordans and said, "Come on, hooligan, you want to play too?" "What the f***, you guys? I couldn't lose my lottery scholarship over this. I already had the Rotzi shit on my record. Let's go already. Cut your shit." Bosco squared up with me, and I was afraid he'd turn his boots on me for a second. I looked back up at him, and he took off ahead of me. We ran through the mechanical engineering courtyard, up a flight of stairs, and popped out behind Hodgen Hall. As we walked down toward Central University in silence, a pair of red eyes opened and blinked at me in the darkness. Normally there were tall pines and a wolf statue at the top of the small hill looking out toward the intersection. I don't remember quite what happened next. There was a screech, like metal on metal, and a thump against my left arm sent me flying. There was a lot of screaming. I felt like I was being stepped on, and then Xander shook me. And as I got up, I got this huge kick of adrenaline, a fight-or-flight response. Xander pointed to Bosco, who was lying face down in a puddle of dark liquid. I tossed him over my shoulders in a buddy carry I learned before I got kicked out of ROTC, and Xander was like, "We gotta run." So I followed him down the hill and into the crosswalk. Cars were honking at us all kinds as we ran across the street, but we made it to the other side. It was a freaking miracle Bosco's stupid hat hadn't fallen off. "He okay?" I said, turning so Xander could take a look at him. From behind me, Xander said, "There's so much blood." He looked past me, back across the street. "Hurry, let's go." We crossed Central and ducked down onto Gold's quiet sidewalks. Xander and I slowed to a walk for a block or two, almost catching our breath, and then I heard it. A clanking, jogging, following us. Xander heard it too, his eyeballs poking out of the half-darkness. As we ran the rest of the way, Bosco groaned in my ear and wiped his hands on my stomach when I bounced over potholes and cracks in the asphalt. I felt his blood on my neck and my shirt, but I didn't look down. Compartmentalization. As we burst through the door to Copper and past the neon sign, everyone in the room turned to look at us, panting, sweating, all of us dripping with blood. And everyone cheered.
And this is Protect the Pack Part 2, which is written from a slightly different perspective in terms of thinking about how stories are told differently by different people that are involved. Everything felt ruptured beneath Jay's skin, blood blooming into bruises beneath the numb ache in his chest. The rainbow line of lights across university spun together with the headlights of the passing cars as he staggered into a pine tree, a place to lay low. Usually the only time people saw him were when he forced them to look, when he took his time crossing Central Avenue, when a car blared its horn because he didn't want to move faster, because he wanted someone to take the time to notice him. Jay wished they wouldn't have noticed him tonight. He rested his head against the tree, wheezed out a cough, damp gully grass pressing into his bare ankles. Another group of students cut down the path through the trees. The kids who had done this had already run off. "Look at that guy," one of them said, pointing to Jay. "He looks like he just got the shit kicked out of him." They laughed, mulch crunching under their staggered footsteps. "Wait," Jay said, voice raspy and unrecognizable under the strain of his lungs. He tried to stand, but little motes of black dotted his vision, a thin crust of blood that spilled from his nose dried onto his lips. "Please just help." His head smacked against the tree, and he tried to steady his breath. The dam of numbness broke into a flood of prickling pain, like the blisters that burst onto your skin from sunburn. "I'll just go to Central. I'll find one of those security guards," he huffed. His shopping cart might be gone by the time he made it back to the wobbling stone courtyard, but none of his belongings could provide any relief or protection. Metal groaned against concrete, and Jay spun his neck as quickly as his body would let him, but Route 66 was barren. No bronze-orange GTO T-boned by an extended cab pickup. No chromed-out classic crushed against the retaining wall or the bus stop that still wasn't in service. The traffic light flipped red, reflecting off the wolf head statue that loomed over this corner of campus. The front paw lifted away from the concrete, patted down in the grass as it turned its head toward him. The weight of the stair fixed Jay in place. It bowed its head and then sprinted off toward downtown, metal footsteps echoing across the earth. Jay shuffled along Central Avenue toward Frontier, checking over his shoulder for the wolf. "Did you see that? Did you see that?" he asked. His clothes felt too tight around his body as his arms flailed, chest and shoulders already swollen. He needed medical help. He should have been resting, not running. A couple holding hands let go of each other to break around him, rejoining once they reached his other side. After he cut across Yale, Jay hugged the buildings, sticking close to the shadows so the fluorescence and neon didn't sting his eyes. Sometimes there was a security guard at McDonald's, working the late-night shift to keep people like him away, to make sure that there weren't any thefts, fights, or vandalism in the store, that somebody didn't OD in the bathroom. But tonight there was no one. Voices spilled out from Brickyard, a cigarette lit and dangling from a man's mouth as he stumbled out of the dark doorway. "Ee, Jesus Christ, watch where you're going." There were a lot more students here, too. People in red shirts with their faces painted for war. They jeered at him. Jay stumbled with his hands out to keep balance, and one woman with a turquoise necklace tried to put a coin in his palm and fold his fingers back to keep it in place. "Kyugabacha, just get me some help." She shrieked and jumped back. The type of person who wanted to build a wall around campus to push the homeless problem further out to a place that couldn't be seen as easily. Jay crossed under the bright lights at the intersection of Cornell, not bothering to look for cars. A man in his late 20s stood near the door of Frontier, with his hands hooked in his belt loops, dark gray uniform with its black and red patch freshly pressed. He scanned the crowd of people, opened the door for a few to walk in. "All right, ma'am, back off," the guard said. He crossed his arms over his chest and stepped out from the entryway, slick black hair tapered around his glasses. "Do we gotta go over this every time? I ask you at least once a week." "I don't want to fight. I just need an ambulance. I'm so tired," Jay said. He fell forward, eyes glossed, adrenaline burn faded. The guard pushed against Jay's shoulder, body lighter than it looked, and shoved him backward. Jay's heel caught a lip in the sidewalk, and he stumbled back over the curb, falling into the street. "I said back off." The guard stood over Jay's prone body as he spoke something into his walkie-talkie. He wasn't paid to protect people, but to protect their sense of comfort. Jay could only make out the word police. He propped himself up on his elbows, grit his teeth against the new pain in the back of his head, and staggered across the road toward campus. One car honked and swerved. Someone else rolled down their window and shouted. He kept running. Jay skirted the edge of shadowed pines along Redondo, where other homeless people nestled in deeper to sleep at night, out of the lamplight where he might be spotted. He didn't want to make trouble for them, to have a cop harass them just because he'd passed by. He cut behind the construction of a new building, turning a corner when a campus police cruiser eked down a sidewalk at a crawl towards his overturned cart. The bronze wolf head in the courtyard of the alumni building leered at the sky, eyes glazed red. Its mouth split open in a shrill howl. Jay froze. He couldn't hear any of the cars on Central, just over the lip of the hill. No students. Silence. The streets erupted around him in yips. Jay focused on his feet, eyes down as he passed the wolf head. His metal clanged off the pavement, dozens of footsteps denting the ground, sprinting past him in a blur. When he got back to the gully, body still aching, head split with pain, the wolf that watched over this corner of campus had returned to its perch. Jay crossed the mulch and grass to its concrete slab, laying down beneath the wolf, its mouth still dripping a slow leak of blood.
That was really cool.
Was
thanks,
awesome.
Y'all.
Yeah, totally. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
So, Tori and Mitch, y'all are both MFA students here at the University of New Mexico?
Yeah. In the English department.
Oh, okay. English specifically.
Yeah.
MA, PhD?
MFA.
Oh.
So specifically in creative writing.
Okay.
Yeah.
And my focus is nonfiction. I started as a fiction student, though.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I started as poetry and went to fiction. So we're just kind of like, we need a nonfiction person to go to poetry, and then we'll have the whole set.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on the poetics of these pieces, Gigi?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've talked a lot recently with other writers about how Albuquerque functions under kind of a different lens as a place. And I think that it has that kind of Latino element of magical realism, but there's always this tinge of like darkness to that, and this both of these joint pieces together really capture that. I'm just kind of curious as to like how you came to writing this together.
Sure. I think it was just sort of like a fluke. I don't know if we were kind of thinking about ideas for this Noir at the Bar reading. And we're kind of like, it'd be neat to write something together. Do you want to write like a werewolf story or something?
Yeah, for a performance piece especially, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, just to like kind of, not to throw a curveball in the readings, but I don't know, just as kind of...
to do something different.
Yeah, just a little surprise. It's not often that like you hear back-to-back part one, part two things at a reading. So, you know. It's kind of neat.
It was cool, too, just to, like, because we didn't really tell anybody else about it either.
Yeah.
So it was, like, my mentality of, like, oh, cool, it's like a noir crime kind of reading. Let's, like, pull off a little caper, too.
Totally.
Like, and I think, like, Tori kicked me an idea about doing something, like, werewolf story-wise. And I was like, well, how do we, like, wrap a crime element into that, too?
Mm-hmm.
And try and, like, play with that idea. And then I was just, like, hanging out, kicking some ideas around one night, and then ran into Tori and was like, what if the statues are just, like, keeping an eye out for all of the people who normally don't get seen? Because after a while, I feel like people stop paying attention to the fact that there are statues on campus too. Yeah. And so just like the sort of pervasiveness of that and how that relates to people intentionally like avoiding eye contact with people on the street or around campus or, you know, other ways that people just aren't seen who really do need help.
Yeah. Especially with this wall. Like, I don't know. That was another thing I kind of wanted to pull attention to is that it's not just that we're unwilling to look at it, but we're so unwilling to look at it that it's like, let's spend all this money on something to cordon the university off from the community? I don't know.
And be seriously inconvenienced, too.
Exactly.
Like, even on a selfish level, it's like, that would be incredibly annoying and hugely problematic.
Yeah,
and
sure.
potentially trapping people in with someone who wants to hurt them.
Exactly. Like
cutting off their avenues of escape.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, terrifying.
I think also there's a lot of duality in the fact that your part one ends and you've got this guy bloodied inside of a bar and people are cheering for that.
Yeah.
But then you've got this other man kind of vehemently looking for help everywhere that he can and nobody notices.
Yeah,
so it's really an issue of like who it is and what's happening. And you can bring class and race into that also to as to who we decide to see, who we decide to notice.
And who we decide to praise or like pardon even.
Sure.
Like they're covered in red. Like, oh, they're full of team spirit. Like, no. You don't see the whole story behind it, and they're willing to, like, cheer for these guys without knowing anything that they've done. So it's kind of like, this is hilarious how scary and relevant.
Yeah.
Maybe. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's something to that idea of, like, pack mentality, too, just as an outsider of, like, if you don't know that Red... Like, I've never gone to Red Rally because I've only been here for a couple years at this point, but, like... If you're walking into something like that and you don't know what's going on and you see people dressed up and all like, you know, that's just like another form of like, I'm really out of place. I don't know what's going on and I feel isolated. And so it's something like this when you have like people coming from that who are drunk and attacking somebody too, like how, and then you're trying to like walk back into an area to get help and you're seeing more people that like look like them keeping you sort of separated from getting the help that you really need for somebody to actually pay attention to what is going on. I think that's just another aspect of that too. And I think the wall around campus idea really symbolizes that of like, I don't know, since I've been here, I've been thinking a lot about community and how like isolated the university feels from the rest of Albuquerque and that just seems problematic for so many reasons as far as like not actually engaging in the community here, which I think, you know, just across campus it would be cool to see more of that engagement of like people at the university like interacting with the community.
That's why I miss winning so much. Like my heart is so broken.
Well, Tori, Mitch, Gigi, thank you all so much for coming in. That was Tori and Mitch, Mitch Marty's jointly written piece called Protect the Pack. Tori Cardenas and Mitch Marty of the MFA program here at the University of New Mexico. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Marty Adam Smith, hosting Spoken Word Hour with a noir fiction radio hour by local authors. I'm in the studio still with Gigi Bella, adding now Justin Bendel and Anna June, both of University of New Mexico Valencia campuses, Department of English?
That's right.
Okay. And what is it that y'all are teaching out there?
That's a great question. Anna, what are you teaching?
Well, right now I'm teaching English 1101 or 1110. We changed the numbers, so we're all and being
nobody
an English major.
Nobody has any idea what class they're
in. I know. Being an English major, I don't do numbers. So I'm teaching three sections of that, and then a section of 100, and then some online for dual credit high school students.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And I'm currently the chair, which means I only teach two classes. I am teaching. Yeah, it is. You know, there's it's a double-edged sword. But I'm teaching an online creative writing class and also an expository online too. So it's cool to teach online classes. You can bring in students from all over the state, really.
And Justin, it was you who coordinated this noir fiction reading at Tractor recently?
Yeah, I actually, an author, Rex Weiner, reached out to me a few months ago because I do a crime fiction podcast, and he just said, hey, you know crime fiction in town. You know any events I could read at when I come in August? And I said, I have no idea, because there wasn't really a coherent scene as far as I knew. So I said, let me get back to you in a couple of weeks. And I set up a Facebook group and sort of generated a scene real quick. I was just testing the waters. And a bunch of people decided they were in, and all of a sudden we had a little movement. And I said, let's do a noir at the bar, and that happened. It all came together really nicely.
Mm-hmm. Sweet. So what's the piece that you brought to read for us today?
I have a funny little noir piece called Pancake. It features clowns, and if you are a clown, I apologize ahead of time. Would you like to talk more about it?
No, go right ahead.
Shall I read it?
Yes, okay. Unless you have more introduction you want
to
do.
No, I'll just go for it.
Okay.
All right. You ever get robbed by a clown? I have. I've been schlepping up Central, peddling my resume to every dead-end dump on the block. My last stop was Western Gas Mart. I stood behind the schmoes with their meat sticks and chips and diet dews. When it was my turn, I slipped my resume under the plexiglass partition. The manager looked it over, then he looked at me and laughed. You're not serious, are you? It was hot as blazes, not a bird singing. I slouched at the bus stop, feeling all kinds of defeat. My stomach was a black knot. Corner of my eye, I see someone sauntering up the sidewalk. White face, green nose, diamond eyes, red mouth, rainbow wig. A clown, a true blue birthday clown. Gave me the creeps. I nodded as he passed, then I turned my attention to the road. The bus was late as usual. The bus was always. It wasn't the pain that came first, it was the sense of movement. I saw blue sky, white sun, then shadow. Came to, I was splayed on the sidewalk, head spinning. It felt like I'd been cuffed by a bear. There stood the clown, silhouetted against the noon sun, blackjack in hand. Wallet, he said. I muttered, don't got anything. Wallet or I smack you silly. I sighed, tossed him my wallet. He opened it and scowled. What's this, Palio? I don't got much, I said. Give me your pants. My pants? You want another whack? I pulled off my pants and handed them over. A clown scampered down the block. Too dazed to give chase, I watched him hop into a red Datsun and peel off. Moments later, the bus rolled up. Driver took one look at me, laughed, and shut the door. I had to walk 2 miles to the flophouse, doing my best to block out the wailing horns and wolf whistles, the young woman shouting, "Nice briefs, loser!" I was red in the face, and not just from the sun. That night, I couldn't sleep a wink, lay in the cot, dripping sweat, anxious. The wallet I could understand, dire straits and all, but the pants... I just couldn't let that go. I had a problem with clowns. When I was 7, I'd gone to Susie McElmore's birthday party. They had a clown there named Sprockets. All the kids were swimming. Alone, I went into the kitchen for a can of soda. Sprockets cornered me. I tried to run, but he pulled me close. Be a good boy, he said. Be a good boy. I stepped on his big red shoe and got away, but I never did forget it. That morning, I trudged to the library and used the last of my pocket change to print the name and number of every clown in Albuquerque. I phoned Abracadabra, Bobo, Buster, Corncob, Darby, Eeyore, Fudd, Garbanzo, Macadamia, Nougat. I hired a dozen clowns for a dozen fake birthday parties, but not a single one sounded like the clown who robbed me. My head was pounding. Just a few more numbers. I'm calling for Silly String, I said. He's on vacation, Palio. Call someone else. Click. I'd found my clown. Soon after, I got his address, a crumbling bungalow near the Rio Grande. I didn't have much of a plan, so I went up the dirt alley behind the house and started flinging pebbles. I ducked away as the door opened. No clown, just a tall-ass chump. I ducked, waited. The door closed. I resumed with the pebbles. The door opened again. Help, I called in my best soprano. The man came out, unlatched the back gate, and looked around. I cracked him with the rolling pin I took from the flophouse kitchen. You like stealing, pal? Stealing my pants? Don't know what you're talking about, he blurted, parrying my blows. I gave him a few more licks and he crumpled. I put him in a half Nelson. Across the alley, someone was painting a garage. They left out their supplies, brushes, roller, bucket of paint. I dragged him to the bucket. Head in the paint, I ordered. Please, no. I smashed his windpipe with my fist and dunked him. His arms flailed, he on his knees in the dust, red sky above, swallow sweeping past. This punk-ass clown, he didn't know who he was dealing with. A stinging thwack sent me flying. I spat dust as a clown shoe ground into my neck. What you doing to my brother, Palio? Thwack, black spots. Thwack, pulsing light. Thwack. It was Silly String standing over me. I didn't do nothing, I hissed. Oh, yes, you did, pal, and you're going to pay. Sirens, then a squad car swinging into the alley. Gone was the pressure on my neck. I popped to my feet, stumbled down the alley, out of sight. Late night, there came a knock at my flophouse door. Through the peephole, I saw nothing. I grabbed the rolling pin, popped the lock. A tiny bald man stared up at me. He had no eyebrows. For you, he said, handing me an envelope. Then he took off down the corridor. It was a letter from the International Order of Merrymakers, and it wasted no words. A bounty has been placed on your head. All regions have been notified. Run, hide, you'll be found. That night, I hitched to Amarillo. I tried to stay one step ahead of them. I slept in squats, drank from hoses. Clowns could be anywhere. Everyone was suspect. I needed a place to hide. And I found it. A flyer, tacked to a phone pole in Midland, Odessa. Rodeo clown tryouts. They must have mistaken panic for charm because I got the job. Worked the rodeo circuit for weeks. Inevitably, the other clowns started asking questions. They wanted to know why I never took my makeup off. I'd hitch to a new town, start over, again, and again, and again. I can't do this any longer, and that's why I'm writing. I didn't mean to hurt Silly String's brother. I swear I didn't. I can't eat. I can't sleep. I know you're watching. Tell me what to do, and I'll do it. I'll join the order. I'll do your dirty work. I even have a name. I don't know if that's something you decide, if it's an order thing, but I wanted you to show I was serious, that I was ready. Please give me another chance. Your clown, Pancake. There we go.
Very cool.
Pancake lives for now.
My 15-year-old son was at the Noir at the Bar, and he absolutely loved your story.
It's good. I got the 15-year-old market.
Yeah. And everybody else, too. But he was actually paying attention, which is quite a feat, you know, with this kid. So. Yeah.
Clowns and swears will do that.
Oh, for sure. So,
cool.
Great.
Yeah, whatever you're ready on it.
All righty. So this piece came about, my husband gave me some random words in a hat, and I pulled some out, and I was supposed to incorporate them. I didn't incorporate all of them, but it helped develop my idea. Typically, I write nonfiction, and I've only written noir once, so it felt like, how do I do that? So having that kind of exercise really helped, and it helped me come up with this, and it is as yet untitled. Daylight is waning, and the wind's picking up, but the small crowd hangs on. They watch from the edge of what used to be old Sheriff Cook's front lawn, before the sprinklers wouldn't run anymore and the drought set in. And I watch back, all of them waiting for something to happen. I'm sitting next to Cook on the ragged couch he dragged out of his house one afternoon in a fluster. I can't deal with the darkness, he'd shouted to nobody in particular. Then he planted himself on that couch and over time began to shed his clothes. I know this because I've been spying on him. And I've been spying on him because, well, that doesn't have anything to do with what brought me here on this late afternoon, a cold wind picking up. Doesn't have anything to do with the pile of rusty saw blades, some of which are sitting at Cook's feet, three of which are lying now across the street. Doesn't have to do with any of that, until it does. The darkness is getting to him, a passerby said, and described how Cook had frisbeed the saw blades at random people nearby. And now, seeing my chance to set things right, here I am. Really, nobody handles the darkness well. When the lights went out, it was still summer, and I didn't start cursing until the comfortable AC chill in my house dissipated and the freezer started leaking meat juice. I blamed the electric company at first, but when signs started pointing to some attack on the country's power grid, I didn't know who to blame or what to do except mill around my house, wondering what it felt like to starve. There's always someone to blame, Valerie, my father used to say to me. Never forget that. And I haven't. But who would I blame when I was twisted with starvation on the floor, refrigerator still shining and new and filled with rotten food? Before I ran out of ramen cups and bottled water, I cracked my father's gun safe, pulled out his .22, and scanned the backyard maple tree for squirrels. Then I saw old Sheriff Cook's cat sunning next door. I was just a kid when my dog, Petra, died. She was a pit bull with one ear up, one down, and she was against the law. You can't have that animal, Cook, who was still the sheriff then, told my father one night. He'd banged on the door, and Petra took to barking as she did. Slobber bubbled on her black lips. I held her collar as my father stepped onto the porch and heard the back and forth between them of my dog's right to exist or not. My father refused to turn her over to animal control. Sheriff Cook said he'd see about that. A week later, Petra was dead. My father mumbled something about antifreeze poisoning as he lifted my dead dog and walked her to a spot under that same backyard maple and began to dig her grave. Too stunned to speak and not wanting my father to see me cry, I looked at anything but Petra, her whitening tongue lifeless in the dust, and that's when I saw Cook standing in the shade of his garage, just within the side door, watching us with arms crossed. Among gas cans, trash receptacles, and gardening tools stored just outside his garage was a large and unmistakable bottle of antifreeze. Right after the burial, my father walked next door and pressed Cook on his role in Petra's death. Cook denied all responsibility. "I do my own automotive work, so of course I have a bottle of antifreeze," Cook shouted, incensed. "Don't you?" "There's always someone to blame," my father muttered when he walked back. He glanced at me as he said it, then shook the dirt from Petra's grave off his boots and came inside. Not long after, my father was dead too, a sudden flurry of seizures taking him home to heaven, as my aunt put it, to see my mother. That same aunt drove me away after the funeral to live with her, and when we passed the sheriff's house, I know I saw him smile. When I was finally of age, my inheritance in hand, I drove back to the house, abandoned since my father's death, pushed my old key into the lock, and was next door once again to old Sheriff Cook. At last. Cook was aged, retired, and widowed. He spent his days poisoning weeds in his grass, trimming his dead wife's rose bushes, and rocking on his porch with his orange cat in his lap. He'd had it since it was a tiny tangerine kitten bounding across the front lawn. By the time I moved back, it walked haltingly on stiff legs and slept for hours on Cook's lap. I know, because that's when I started spying on Cook with an antique periscope my father left me, thinking all the while about Petra in the dust, Petra in her grave. So after the lights went out and didn't come on again, and after Cook hauled his couch onto the front yard, and after visions of starvation overtook me to the point that I was hunting squirrels in my backyard, and after I saw Cook's cat, in that microscopic moment of infinite possibilities, I lifted the rifle, centered the bright orange beast in my scope. By then it wasn't Petra on my mind. All I could see was my father, and how his face contorted when the first seizure hit him. That's when I realized. Old Sheriff Cook hadn't stopped with taking my dog. My finger curled around the trigger. I closed my eyes. You don't realize how much you need light until it's gone. Don't know how the night can strangle you until all you can do is sit in darkness, waiting for the sun to rise, with a nothing landscape of wandering people, those who somehow survive, and cars decaying on the roadways. I think of all the zombie movies I ever watched and know that this is worse, much worse. I trade out the .22 for my father's pistol, holster it, try to imagine that the weight of it could crack this darkness open, even for just a moment. By the time I'm sitting on old Cook's couch, he's naked to his boxers, sunburned and shivering. I can tell he hasn't the strength left to heft another saw blade, and because I've been well-trained to be a people-pleaser, despite my father's constant reminder that there's always someone to blame, I remark on Cook's ingenuity. Lacking his service revolver, I figure, he resorted to what he could get his hands on. "Creative," I say, to break the silence, then kick the remaining blades away with the tip of my boot. Cook looks on, refusing to meet my eyes, as the sun melts into streaks of orange and peach, two fruits I might not ever eat again, and the crowd thins. One person here, two there, until only the diehards remain, squinting through the dusk light, waiting for something to happen. When the last of that light dissolves and the night settles, Cook sucks in his breath and says, "Have you seen my cat?" I unholster my gun. "Why would I have seen your cat?" "I heard a shot earlier." He lets his words fall away. "What did it sound like?" I press the gun almost tenderly into old Sheriff Cook's gaunt ribs. He doesn't react. Between us, the darkness so complete he could be centimeters from my face, and I wouldn't see him. I don't have to close my eyes. My father's voice fills my head, and I cock the pistol, lean close. There's always someone to blame, I say.
Cool.
Slow burn revenge.
Anything else y'all want to tell our listeners about those pieces?
Well, I'll speak briefly to mine. I wrote this, I've been working on a novel for several years, and maybe not that long, but it certainly feels like it. And so I just wanted to clear my head and write something short. And I've been reading and thinking a lot about crime fiction, and I wanted to write something short, fun, punchy, but also good for an audience. You know, I was going for laughs. I wanted it to be, I wanted it to have the right beats. So, and I've always had clowns on my mind. I have clown trauma.
You yourself have clown trauma. Oh,
absolutely.
Like your character.
Totally. I watched Poltergeist when I was a kid, and I had this, in like kindergarten, they had us made these clown posters with like crepe paper, and had that on my wall for years. And I'd wake up with chronic nightmares. My mom was like, I think it's the clown, man. Like, she took the clown picture gone, and also my He-Man like horror scene next to my bed. And once those were gone, I slept better. But since then, I've had issues with clowns. So I've always wanted to write a clown story, and I have some false starts. So here's my the one that I finished. So
great. And Anna,
I don't know what this is going to, if it's going to become anything else. I had a wholly different concept before, and I really do want to write some sort of like apocalyptic fiction, more than I already have. I tend to prefer long form, so short form was definitely a challenge for me, because I could get long winded, and then just keep writing and never quite finish. I've been working on a novel for, I don't even want to say, 20 years? Very, very long time. Honestly, having this deadline of knowing I had to read in front of people was exactly what I needed. I kind of need that regularly.
Totally.
The pressure really helps.
The pressure helps tremendously. I was literally writing this in the car on the way over there, or finishing it.
Yeah.
Which is why it stayed on this, because I could transfer it from my computer. So yeah, I enjoyed it though.
Great.
I really did.
Yeah, questions for them, Gigi?
What were some of the words that your husband gave you to use in your story?
That's a good question.
Yeah, he gave me discarded couch, and that was like the one that really kind of focused itself in my head. So
that
that's what I
like a band name.
Gave him that. Yes. So that's why I gave him the couch on the lawn. What else did he give me? That's the one I really remember, and everything kind of gelled around that. Actually, I had like 10, and he was like, you got to use all of them. I was like, well, I don't know that I can, but the discarded couch is fantastic. So I have a thing about like discarded furniture. You see it like in an environment where you don't expect to see something like that, you know, especially in New Mexico. You drive over a hill and there's a chair, and there's something about that I just find fascinating. So
you could wrap a whole collection of stories around something like a discarded couch, all the different ways
for
that
sure.
It could manifest, where it came, where it goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And I think in the clown piece, it's really interesting how this guy is just handing out resumes, and then before you know it, he's sucked into like a life of revenge and clowning. Did you intend for that originally to happen?
You know, I was walking around my neighborhood, and I came up with the line, you ever get robbed by a clown? I have. Popped in my head, and I was like, okay, there we go. I got to race home and make this happen. So I knew the robbery was going to happen. I wasn't sure what the stakes were and who this guy was. And over time, and talking to a couple of people, I realized I needed to make this person down and out. They needed to be teetering in life in order to make all this sort of sell itself. Mm-hmm. So then I added the job stuff a little bit later. I wanted to show that this person had next to nothing, and now had nothing to lose, really, except his pants. I needed to sell the pants bit, because it's absurd, and it doesn't really sell itself if the person's just like, yeah, you stole my pants, I'll get over it, I'll go buy some you had to have
that
like...
reminded me of Tortilla Flats by Steinbeck. Where they are using pants for their exchange value.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I read that twice actually, but me not too. For a long time.
yeah.
That's interesting. With all that Shakespearean language.
It's
in
called
that
the Palace Flophouse, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So the Flophouse plus the pants.
Huh.
Yeah.
That could have been subconscious.
Yeah, totally.
That's interesting.
Well, Anna, Gigi, Justin, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us, Marty.
Thank you very much.
This is Marty Adam Smith, spoken word, our host, in the studio with multiply published crime fiction author Steve Brewer, co-owner of Organic Books in Knob Hill here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thanks so much for coming in, Steve.
Thank you. I'm going to read from my work in progress, which will be my 32nd published book when it comes out this winter. It's called Upshot, and it's from the beginning. Chapter 1. Rick Everett hated the waiting. The last few minutes before a heist were mental torture as his quick mind ran through all the things that could go wrong. Outwardly, he was calm, but he felt strung tighter with each passing minute. Didn't help that he and Sid Miller were parked illegally on a downtown street, the hazard lights flashing on Rick's 20-year-old Crown Victoria. He felt exposed, easy pickings for some curious cop on the prowl. The Albuquerque Police Department's headquarters was less than a mile away, a fact Rick kept pushing from his mind. He tried to avoid looking at the dashboard clock. Instead, he looked over at Sid, his longtime friend and partner in crime. Sid happily sprawled in the passenger seat, looking so relaxed that he might doze off. "You love this, don't you?" "What?" Sid said. "The waiting?" "All of it. The job. You love it more than anything." Sid's broad face split into a smile, and his bushy gray eyebrows bobbed as if they were nodding for him. Like Rick, he was dressed in jeans and a hooded gray sweatshirt and a black knit watchman's cap, like he was going to work outdoors. Both also wore bright blue latex gloves purchased from my hospital supply store. "I am a simple locksmith," Sid said. "I'm 65 years old, married to the same woman for 40 years. So, this is the most excitement I ever get. It does keep the blood moving." Rick glanced at his mirrors. Lots of parked cars, but hardly any traffic on this section of First Street, 8 blocks north of busy Lomas Boulevard. Aged warehouses lined the east side of the street, built flush to the sidewalk, filling a 3-block-long tract between First Street and the railroad tracks. Across the street stood a boarded-up brewery and the blue stucco backside of an auto parts distributor. The windowless walls made a concrete canyon of the 2-lane street. How long could they sit here blocking one of the lanes without drawing the attention of the police? Nate Bowen stood on the sidewalk nearby, his gloved hands hidden in the pockets of his hoodie. Nate just loitering there, trying not to be obvious. Tough job for Nate, a 5-foot-tall wrestler with enormous arms and shoulders. Sid's cell phone trilled. He used a blue latex finger to punch the button to answer. "Yes?" The phone was set on speaker so Rick could hear, too. "The van just passed by," Tim Nix said over the 10E speaker. "They're right on schedule." "Thanks, kid," Sid said brightly. "We'll see you at the garage." He stowed the phone in his pocket, then bent to the floorboard for one of the 12-gauge riot guns stashed there under an old blanket. Rick took the stubby shotgun's twin and set it across the steering wheel. Rick tooted the horn to alert Nate, who nodded, then bent at the waist and picked up a rusty car wheel. He handled the 20-pound wheel as easily as Rick would toss around a paper plate. Nate cradled the wheel against his chest, stealing glances over his shoulder toward Lomas. Watching this in the mirror, Rick said to Sid, "He's ready." "All right," Sid said. "Time to go to work." He and Rick reached up and rolled down their black knit caps, which became ski masks that covered everything but their eyes. They pulled up the hoods of their sweatshirts as an extra layer of urban camouflage. They each pumped a round into the chamber of their shotguns, then held the guns pointed skyward, ready to go. Rick watched the rear view, waiting. Chapter 2. Ooh, it's a fragrant load today, Kevin Perry shouted over the roar of the van's engine. Makes my eyes water. Keep your eyes on the road, said Vern Sanders. Before he retired from APD, Vern spent 30 years as a street cop. His nose had been broken 4 times, mostly sucker punches from drunks, and his sense of smell was poor. But today, even Vern was affected by the stench of marijuana wafting from the back of the van. Guards employed by Thunderbird Security weren't allowed to roll down the windows. They couldn't very well trail the pungent odor of cannabis everywhere they went. Anonymity was the whole point of the unmarked vans. Guards didn't even get proper uniforms. They wore company-issued blue polo shirts and black tactical pants with so many zippers and pockets, Vern still hadn't figured out how to use them all. If it weren't for the Glocks holstered at their hips, he and Kevin could be mistaken for Best Buy clerks. Not the way Vern had expected to spend his retirement years. But most of his retirement savings had been gobbled up by a surprise divorce, and courier work paid the bills. The job wasn't bad, though the jolting ride made his 60-year-old bones ache. The white Ford Transit vans were lightly armored, which didn't change their outward appearance, but the extra weight required heavy-duty suspension. The suspension was so stiff, even the smoothest roads felt like a ride on a pogo stick. The dizzying effect was heightened by a slight waviness in the half-inch thick windows. All of Thunderbird Security's publicity literature called the glass bulletproof, but Vern knew that was true only if someone shot the van's big sloping windshield with a pistol or a shotgun. A rifle bullet could pierce that glass, especially if it came with a bunch of friends. They'd already run most of their Monday route, so there was only 30 pounds of cannabis left in the back of the van. At each of their stops, a dispensary employee with a special key opened a drawer, took out 10 pounds of plastic-wrapped marijuana, and replaced it with $30,000 in cash. Because of federal regulations, most banks still wouldn't deal with the cannabis business, so actual currency was a rule in the trade, which created a profitable niche for courier companies like Thunderbird Security. Take the next left. Kevin rolled his eyes. I know. The kid had only been with Thunderbird Security for 7 weeks, so he was officially still in training. Like most of the company's hires, he was fresh out of the military and felt like he already knew everything. 2 tours in Afghanistan had him convinced he was pretty much bulletproof, too. Vern straightened in the passenger seat as they drove north on First Street through the warehouse district. The shadowy 2-lane was the only bottleneck along this particular route, and it always made him nervous. The street was lined by parked cars, but one brown sedan was stopped in their lane, its hazard lights flashing. Near the car, a broad-shouldered man stood on the sidewalk, his back to the approaching van. He wore jeans and a gray sweatshirt with the hood pulled up, though it was a sunny October day. At first, Vern thought the hooded man was on his knees, maybe working on a tire. Then he realized the guy was simply short. He was hugely muscled up all over, making him look top-heavy. What was he doing? Looked like some kind of tool on the sidewalk near him. Vern squinted, trying to see better. They were zipping along, Kevin doing his usual 5 miles per hour over the speed limit, so they were upon the flashing car too quickly for Vern to voice his growing concern. The man on the sidewalk spun around, and Vern saw he wore a ski mask over his face. He had something large and round in his hand, swinging at the end of his arm as he whirled, as if throwing a discus. Vern got just a glimpse of the flying wheel before it smashed the center of the windshield, spiderwebbing the thick glass and bouncing away. The crash was so loud and surprising, Kevin stomped the brake. The tire shrieked. "Don't stop," Vern shouted. "I can't see." "Go." Vern fumbled for his holstered pistol, but his seatbelt was in the way. "It's a trap." The van surged forward, swinging into the oncoming lane to go around the stalled brown sedan. Too late, Vern saw that another vehicle turned on the First Street from a parking lot up ahead. A silver tow truck with dual rear wheels roared toward them. Its entire front end was protected by a black grid of welded steel pipes above a heavy-duty bumper. Vern couldn't see well through the fractured windshield, but it looked like the tow truck driver also wore a black ski mask and a white crash helmet. Oh, Kevin hit the brakes, but it was too late. The wrecker collided head-on with the armored van. Vern's seatbelt dug into his belly as the impact threw him forward. A flash, then his vision filled with dazzling white as an airbag abruptly inflated in his face, knocking him senseless.
Very interesting. That was Steve Brewer, crime fiction author, local to Albuquerque. The work was the first two chapters of his work in progress, novel in progress, called Upshot. Thanks so much for coming in, Steve.
My pleasure. Thank you.